The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the History of Japan podcast, episode 463, The Afterlives of a Samurai. On the morning of the sixth day of the fourth intercalary month of 1868, which, if I'm doing my math right, is May 29th, 1868, though converting from the lunar calendar is not something I'm great at, a bound man was taken out of a makeshift prison on the banks of the Kawazu River in the village of Mizunuma, in what's now Gunma Prefecture, northwest of Tokyo. The man's arms and legs were bound, and he was taken to the banks of the river. That didn't seem to dampen his spirits over much, though, when one of his captors pushed him roughly forward, he reputedly called the man a disrespectful lout. Despite his bravado, the man couldn't do much about being forced to bend over. After being allowed some final words, asking apparently for clemency for his family, a low-ranking samurai drew a sword and decapitated the prisoner. Apparently, it took him three swings before the head came off. The decapitated man's name was Oguri Tadamasa, and in his rather violent death, he holds a somewhat unique distinction. You see, Oguri died in 1868 in the midst of the Boshin War that brought about the downfall of samurai rule in Japan and the inauguration of a new imperial government, the Meiji Restoration, as it's often known. Commonly, the conflicts of the Boshin War and the Restoration are talked about in a rather peculiar way in Japan. If you go to the country today, you'll notice that commemorations tend to be somewhat, for lack of a better term, politically agnostic. To put it another way, there are no villains, or at least very few. Everyone is a hero, fighting for their idea of a good future for Japan. The whole thing is very reminiscent of a sort of Shakespearean tragedy, all of these noble figures driven to their tragic but inevitable conflict with one another. You're just as likely, if not more so, to come across a monument or exhibit or whatnot valorizing someone on the losing side as you are someone on the winning side. Interestingly, this is also how the civil wars of the old samurai clans during the 1400s and 1500s are often portrayed. But as the fate of Oguri Tadamasa makes clear, this was not how things worked in the immediate aftermath of the conflict. It is true that many former retainers of the Tokugawa shoguns, after the defeat of the shogunate and the rise of the new imperial government, were able to find some form of gainful employment as journalists or business people or even, in some cases, politicians in the new imperial government. Enomoto Takeaki, for example, went from trying to lead a breakaway pro-Tokugawa holdout regime on the northern island of Hokkaido to helping direct the colonization of that island on behalf of the imperial government. Katsu Kaishu went from the guy who surrendered Edo, now Tokyo, to the new government, to a member of the Emperor's Privy Council. But dramatic rises like this were the exception, not the rule. For most of the Meiji period, a far older tradition for dealing with the defeated held sway. That tradition is best summarized by a phrase that pops up a lot in relation to Japanese history. Kateba kangun, makereba zokugun. Roughly, if you win, you are the Emperor's army and thus on the right side, and if you lose, you are bandits. So how did we get from that attitude, from Oguri being decapitated for being on the wrong side, to this valorization of both sides? That's what today is about, with a particular focus on Oguri specifically. But first, of course, we have to talk about who Oguri was and why he merited such a violent end, or at least merited it in the eyes of those who killed him. Oguri was a samurai, and thus, like all good samurai tales, we should start things off by talking about his family, and oh, what a family history it is. The Oguri were long-standing followers of the Tokugawa clan, and I do mean long-standing. They were loyal to the Tokugawa long before anyone could have guessed that the Tokugawa were destined to become Japan's most powerful samurai family. The Oguri family's rise to prominence is tied most directly to its fourth-generation family head, Oguri Shojiro. Shojiro was a follower of Tokugawa Ieyasu during Ieyasu's earliest years, when Ieyasu was a subordinate first of the neighboring warlord Imagawa Yoshimoto, and then of the man who conquered Yoshimoto, Oda Nobunaga. Shojiro followed his master Ieyasu into Nobunaga's service and in 1570 was present for the Battle of Anegawa, where Ieyasu and Nobunaga faced down two rival clans, the Azai and Asakura. Here, Shojiro first came to prominence. He saved Ieyasu from a spearman who had snuck up on him in the chaos of battle, grabbing the spear from the spearman and then striking him down. After the battle, Ieyasu granted this spear to Shojiro, a mark of pretty substantial favor as a gift. When Shojiro continued to distinguish himself in future battles at Mikatagahara in 1573 and Nagashino in 1575, both against another rival, the Takeda clan, Ieyasu favored him further by granting him a new personal name, Mataichi, roughly, once again, number one. From this point onward, the senior male of each generation of the Oguri family has used Mataichi as a given name in honor of that legacy. The name was used as a kemyo, or assumed name, so they would continue to use their actual given names in other contexts, and I'm gonna keep using the original given names for Oguri men, just to keep things less confusing. If all of this seems kind of odd to you, just think of it as a way of honoring the family legacy in each generation, by trying to keep the name of the man who brought the family to fame alive. Because oh boy, did Oguri Shojiro set his family up well. He himself would, tragically, not live to see the new order of things. He died, actually, during the last battle of his lifetime, the final siege of Osaka Castle in the summer of 1615, when he was struck by a bullet fired from the walls. However, in the new order that emerged from the chaos of the fighting, one where, through skillful political maneuvering, Tokugawa Ieyasu himself rose to supreme power and had himself declared the shogun, the ruler of the country, well, the Oguri were very well off. The Oguri family was granted hereditary status as Hatamoto, direct bannerman of the shogun, who would serve him and help him manage his new government. Not only were they Hatamoto, in fact, but among Hatamoto they were some of the very best off. The shogun's direct bannerman had the distinction of receiving actual fiefs with a fixed regular income, as opposed to the shogun's lower-ranking retainers, who were only paid if they had an office with some kind of salary. But even for Hatamoto, the pay was not usually amazing. Income during this time was measured in koku, or bushels of rice. Even other types of production had to be converted into rice equivalents, so to speak, to track their tax value. Most Hatamoto families had fairly minor stipends relative to their elite rank. Nearly 70% received less than 1,000 koku per year. The Oguri, by comparison, got 2,500, placing them among the uppermost levels of the shogun's direct retainers. For the next 2.5 centuries, the members of the Oguri family lived comfortable but unremarkable lives by the standards of Tokugawa bannermen, dedicated to serving the shogun as needed as well as managing their various fiefs, composed of villages dispersed widely over central Japan, rather than a single contiguous unit of land. That is, of course, until the generation of Oguri Tadamasa. Tadamasa was the firstborn son of his father, Oguri Tadataka, and his wife Kuniko, born in 1827 in the family's small complex in the ritzy Surugadai neighborhood, just a few blocks north of what was then the palace of the shogun. It's now the Imperial Palace. Early on in the boy's life, there was little that would have marked Oguri Tadamasa's career as different from that of his forebears. It was not until 1859, 4 years after Tadamasa's father died and he succeeded as family head, that Tadamasa's life began to take on a distinctive arc all its own. In that year, Tadamasa was granted the rank of Metsuke by the man who was, at that moment, the most powerful person in Japan, Inosuke, the Tairo, or senior elder, responsible for managing Japan on behalf of the then-boy shogun Tokugawa Iemochi. The role of the Metsuke during the age of the Tokugawa shoguns was a rather nebulous one. The title literally means something like fixing the eyes and is often described as a sort of censor or inspector. Essentially, Metsuke were charged with overseeing daily affairs and reporting back to the shogunal leadership, particularly around issues of corruption or bad administration. So why then did Inosuke decide to promote Tadamasa to this role, something previously outside the purview of the Oguri family? It's not quite clear, but we can guess based on the circumstances. Inosuke ruled Japan at a time of substantial crisis, when the unequal treaties imposed by Western colonial powers on Japan at gunpoint were driving substantial discontent among the samurai and the nobility in Kyoto. Ii's goal was to clamp down on this dissent and strengthen the government of the Tokugawa shoguns, and then use that strength to modernize the nation's economy and build up its military power in order to eventually confront the West and end the unequal treaties. Oguri seems to have been sympathetic to that strategy. He viewed the West as a threat to the rule of the Tokugawa shoguns, not unjustifiably, but felt that the way to deal with them was first to shore up the shogunate's rule at home, and then to concentrate on building up Japan's economic and military power. Their shared political sympathies, combined with the fact that Tadamasa was from a reliable family, so to speak, after all the Oguri had done very well under the Tokugawa shoguns, and were thus incentivized to keep the system alive, probably contributed to Tadamasa's selection as a Metsuke. Not only did Inosuke trust Oguri Tadamasa as a Metsuke, he trusted the man enough to send him on one of the shogunate's most important assignments, the 1860 Overseas Mission to America, Japan's first diplomatic mission abroad since the 1600s. The ostensible goal of the mission was the ratification of the 1858 Unequal Treaty between Japan and the United States, but the senior samurai negotiators, including Oguri, were also ordered to begin conversations around potential revision of that treaty. This was a pretty important job. After all, treaty revision was a long-term goal. The fact that Oguri was picked for it indicates a lot of trust in him specifically. Inosuke also signaled his trust in Tadamasa by elevating him, before he left, to the ceremonial title of Bungo no Kami, or Governor of Bungo Province, a title with no actual power, because it was derived from the thousand-year-old government system of the imperial court, but a fair amount of prestige attached to it. Oguri was thus in the United States when his patron, Inosuke, was assassinated in March of 1860 by a radical band of samurai dedicated to the idea of imperial loyalism. The loyalists, you'll recall, were dedicated to the somewhat vague goals of expelling foreign influence in Japan immediately, without any of that building up of strength Inosuke advocated for, and to the restoration of rule by the emperor, a somewhat vague idea but one that clearly entailed the destruction of the Tokugawa shogunate. Inosuke's death would see those who shared his views, hardline pro-shogunate leaders, who wanted to crush dissent within Japan to strengthen the shogunate's rule, retreat from political power in favor of moderates, who promoted a less heavy-handed approach of collaboration with the imperial court to shore up the shogunate's legitimacy. In this new political environment upon returning from the United States, Oguri Tadamasa was thus a bit on the outs. He was very much a pro-Inosuke-style Tokugawa ruler and a hardliner on the question of the shogun's authority. Making alliances with the imperial court, a proposition that required, among other things, the admission that the shogun needed the court's help, was not something that he was interested in doing. On the other hand, thanks to his time in America, Oguri was one of the Tokugawa shogunate's most veteran diplomats in terms of handling foreigners, so he couldn't just be disposed of off to political irrelevancy. He was too useful for that. Instead, Oguri became one of the shogunate's point men for putting out fires around the country related to the foreign issue. For example, in March of 1861, the Russian frigate Posadnik, captained by Nikolai Birilev, arrived at the Japanese-held island of Tsushima in the straits between Korea and Japan. Birilev claimed the Posadnik was damaged and needed to harbor at Tsushima for temporary repairs. In practice, he was hoping to meet with the local ruler, the daimyo of the So clan, and secure a lease for a repair yard that would serve as a Russian base on the island. Oguri was sent to handle the issue and get rid of the Russians, and had a series of very tense meetings with Birilev, blocking the captain from even meeting with representatives of the So clan face-to-face on the grounds that foreign diplomacy was strictly the purview of the shogun. Supposedly at their last meeting on May 18, 1861, Oguri went so far as to say that since he would not back down on this matter, quote, "if you don't concur, then you should shoot me as you see fit." Bold words, to say the least, and they did quiet Birilev. But ultimately, the shogunal authorities in Edo chose to ignore the advice Oguri was sending back home, that the shogunate could dispatch some of its own small fleet of Western-built ships to scare off the Russians, leaving the So clan of Tsushima, a very strategic island, in the shogunate's debt. Instead, the shogunate asked the British to intervene against the Russians, which the British were happy to do, chasing off the Russian ship. But in the offing, the shogunate missed the chance to bolster its own position instead of relying on outside help. Oguri would ultimately refuse to continue working as a foreign envoy for the shogunate in the aftermath of the crisis on Tsushima, but he was too loyal to go fully into retirement. Instead, he would spend the next few years focused on reforming the shogunate's own military, for example, beginning the process of arming and reorganizing some of its samurai into Western-style infantry units, as well as beginning the process of setting up a military shipyard at Yokosuka. He even went so far, in the second case, as to leverage his personal connections to the very wealthy Mitsui merchant family, yes, isn't that Mitsui group that's still a major corporation today, to help cover the costs. Oguri's career is obviously impressive, but he's best remembered for the positions he took starting in 1866. Oguri was, by 1866, one of the shogunate's leading military men, and deeply involved in its finances at this point as well, thanks to his Mitsui connections. As a result, when the military fortunes of the shogunate began to turn in a series of reversals starting in 1866, he was one of the ones trying to figure out how to respond. As a refresher, those reversals briefly were, first, the first defeat of shogunal forces in over 200 years, when the shogun's armies were sent against the domain of Choshu and roundly beaten. Second, the death of the shogun Iemochi in the early fall. And third, the death of the shogunate's vocal backer, Emperor Komei, early in 1867. There was not a lot of agreement among the Tokugawa leadership on how to respond to these problems. Ultimately, the man chosen to take over as shogun, Tokugawa Yoshinobu, decided to accept defeat and give up his titles and power. Oguri, however, was absolutely unwilling to do this. He remained unbending in his support for a military solution to the shogunate's problems. Even as Choshu forces, now allied to other anti-Tokugawa fiefdoms like Satsuma, marched on Kyoto to liberate the emperor and restore imperial rule, and even as this newly minted Imperial Japanese Army defeated another Tokugawa force sent to resecure Kyoto in early 1868, Oguri remained unwavering. He ordered shogunal forces to attack the mansion of the Satsuma domain lord in Edo, still full of Satsuma samurai, an action that probably helped precipitate an all-out war, where peaceful negotiations between the Tokugawa and Imperial loyalist domains had still been a possibility. Oguri was actually among the small crew who argued for an all-out battle to hold on to the shogunate's capital at Edo, pushing for the core of the Tokugawa military to try and hold the imperial forces at the passes leading into the Kanto Plains, where Edo is situated. Once pinned in place, Oguri argued, the imperial forces could be blasted to bits by shore bombardments from the Tokugawa fleet, the one area where the shogunate still had an advantage. To be fair, it is not impossible that that would have worked, but it also probably would have destroyed huge swaths of eastern Japan and possibly Edo itself if the fighting moved out of the passes. Ultimately, Oguri was overruled. To be fair, he was not very diplomatic about his views, at one point grabbing a recalcitrant Hatamoto by his clothing and shouting, "What will your cowardice accomplish?" in his face. Views on this plan were mixed among the opposition as well. One of the early leaders of the Imperial Japanese Army, Omura Masujiro, is said to have remarked that Oguri's plan would have absolutely defeated the Imperial forces. However, one of his colleagues, Eto Shimpei, had a somewhat different assessment. Quote, "Oguri was that kind of an ass. That's why they didn't buy into his plan." Oguri Tadamasa was dismissed from his office shortly after these debates, and by the end of the first lunar month of 1868 had retired to one of his fiefdoms, the small village of Gonda in Kosuke Province, now more or less Gunma Prefecture. He lived there in seclusion until the fourth lunar month of 1868, when the Imperial Japanese Army arrived in Kosuke. The local daimyo, by this point smelling which way the wind was blowing, largely capitulated to the advancing force, the Tosando Army as it was known, ostensibly led by the son of the aristocrat Iwakura Tomomi, though in practice the younger Iwakura was a teenager, much beholden to the advice of the actual commander Itagaki Taisuke. Arriving in Kosuke and stabilizing the province, the Tosando Army leadership issued an order on the 22nd day of the fourth lunar month, ordering Oguri arrested. The order read, quote, "Recently Oguri built a fort on his fief, Gonda Village, and has set up a gun battery. He is planning something evil, and reports from various sources are difficult to dismiss. We are certain he is planning a rebellion. He has wicked intentions toward the emperor and wants to return Tokugawa Yoshinobu to power. We are calling on the domains to arrest him. We will send several units to destroy him in one swift motion." This order, you can see, alludes to two bits of evidence of Oguri's treason, his possession of a cannon and his construction of a fortress. To take the second first, Oguri was building atop a mountain near Gonda Village. He was building a family compound, which, like all samurai compounds, was walled, but not exactly fortified. He did also own a cannon. It arrived in Gonda from his home in Edo, where it had been a decorative piece early in the fourth lunar month. But it was a decorative piece. I am unclear whether he even had ammunition for it or if it could even fire. But that sort of thing was not important, honestly. Oguri was arrested less because of what he did and more because of fear that he could become a rallying point for anti-imperial army discontent. When imperial forces showed up in Gonda Village, he was cooperative and argued his innocence against the charges of planning a rebellion, but ultimately unsuccessful. Oguri was arrested and, as already said, beheaded, followed by his adoptive son and many of his retainers, though the rest of his family was allowed to leave in peace. What I find really interesting about Oguri, though, is not so much his life and death, though those are interesting, but his transformation over time since. Because, you see, here's the thing about the history of conflict, really any conflict. There's the fighting itself, which represents one battle, but more or less, as soon as the dust settles, a second and far longer battle starts. This is the battle over memory, over how the conflict will be commemorated, and that conflict, despite what might appear to be lower stakes, is actually very important. This is what shapes our view of the past, and thus, in a sense, our view of the present. And almost as soon as the Meiji Restoration ended, battle lines were drawn in this new conflict over memory. On the one side, were historians and scholars operating with the official backing of the new imperial government, which in turn was very invested in shaping a specific historical narrative about Japan's past. In this narrative, warriors like the Oguri family were usurpers who had seized power from their rightful overlord, the emperor, and overturned the natural order of things. And in this telling, the Meiji Restoration represented both a return to the correct order of things and a casting off, in the form of the shogun, of old and useless traditions in favor of what was modern, which is Western. On the other side of this conflict were former Tokugawa retainers who had survived the conflict and resented being painted as either usurpers or backward feudal remnants trapped in a benighted past, or as disloyal traitors to the throne. Both sides fought a substantial war of words intended to correct the record about what really happened, though in both cases, of course, the necessity of convincing everyone their interpretation was right took precedence over petty trivialities like the facts and things that actually happened. Ogiri Tadamasa and his legacy were caught up almost immediately in this war of words, with the imperial government striving to justify his execution and the remaining Tokugawa believers out there trying to cast doubts around it. Witness, for example, one Fukuchi Genichiro, also a former samurai in service of the shogunate who, after it collapsed, took up publishing a newspaper called the Koko Shinbun to critique the new order of things and defend the legacy of the shogunate. Here's what Fukuchi had to say about Oguri's execution. Quote, "Ogiri was a resolute person who put public affairs before his own. He faced all the problems of the nation and never gave up. However, he was stubborn and did not get along well with others. Still, hearing about his death, I feel the imperial nation lost someone important. Moreover, they did not investigate his crime, they just slaughtered him, and I do not know why." Critiques like this did not go unanswered. One of the government's first directives in 1870 banned all newspapers that didn't have official recognition. Fukuchi Genichiro was jailed shortly thereafter for subversion. In general, the 1870s were a dangerous time to criticize Japan's new government. This was the period of consolidation against samurai and peasant rebellions, when the foundations of the state were still a bit shaky, and thus when anyone critical of the new government had to walk a pretty fine line, lest they find themselves on the wrong end of the law. However, as politics began to stabilize in the 1880s, anti-government critics like Fukuchi were able to return to work. In particular, Fukuchi himself began to write a series of popular histories, On the Decline and Fall of the Shogunate and Statesmen of the Bakumatsu were his two most popular ones, intended to rehabilitate the image of the shogunate and attack the new government all the more. In Fukuchi's telling, the Tokugawa shoguns were not backward usurpers, but brilliant rulers who had stabilized and secured Japan, and who, by issuing orders in the name of the emperor, had increased reverence for the imperial throne among the masses. Ogiri Tadamasa actually played a very special role in Fukuchi's narrative. Fukuchi pointed to Oguri's obsession with strengthening the government using foreign technology, and drew an explicit connection between that idea and the priorities of the new imperial government, which was, after all, in the midst of rapidly westernizing Japan. Oguri's ideas, Fukuchi said, were thus triumphant. He might have been branded a traitor and then killed, but the government was following his vision for strengthening Japan. Fukuchi was not the only one pushing this line, to be clear. At the same time he was publishing these works, another former retainer of the Tokugawa shogunate, Tsukigoshi Yoshitaro, wrote a biography of Ogiri, the first one ever published, actually. In Tsukigoshi's telling, Ogiri was a national hero who had transcended narrow loyalty to the pro- and anti-shogunate sides of the 1860s, and instead done what he felt was best for Japan as a nation. Here is an actual quote from the biography which pulls no punches. "Sure, Ogiri was the strongest supporter of the shogunate, and he amassed foreign debt to defeat Satsuma and Choshu domains, but he was nothing less than a patriot of the times. Unlike the small, close-minded patriots who, focusing their loyalties on the court, advocated the expelling of barbarians, Ogiri was a patriot who worked for the long-term good of Japan. He did what he could within his position, and understood the meaning of civilized patriotism." These views represented a substantial challenge to the official interpretation of history presented by the government, but the orthodox views still tended to predominate. There's no better example than the history of Yokosuka, the town where Ogiri had helped set up Japan's first naval shipyard, though the yards themselves were not finished until 1871, a few years after his death. Still, Ogiri was central to getting them started, yet despite that accomplishment, he himself was largely written out of the history of Yokosuka. For example, a history of the Imperial Japanese Navy published in 1905 spent less than one page on him, devoting far more time to subordinates who'd had the good sense to defect to the new imperial government and who were thus more politically acceptable. 1916 saw a 50-year anniversary celebration of the Yokosuka shipyards, which Oguri had begun and which were now a centerpiece of Japan's national naval strategy. Oguri, as well as his patron, Inosuke, were celebrated by the locals as foundational figures for the shipyard, but as a result, pretty much every major politician of late Meiji Japan, normally happy to rush to any military-related event, stayed far away from this one. But even here, the winds of change were already starting to show. By the start of the 20th century, the conflicts of pre-1868 Japan had already begun to recede into memory, and felt far less contested and loaded than they once had been. After all, the issue was now fundamentally settled. The shogunate itself was long dead, and there were newer enemies, socialists and communists, for example, to draw the ire of the state, which made Oguri more acceptable, for lack of a better word. For example, at those 50-year Yokosuka celebrations, the foremost guest was the man of the hour, Togo Heihachiro, the admiral who, 11 years earlier, had led Japan to its heroic sea victory against Russia, and thus sealed victory in the Russo-Japanese War. And in his speech, Togo more or less directly credited Oguri Tadamasa for Japan's victory against Russia, saying the Yokosuka yards had been essential for the construction of a fleet strong enough to beat the Russians, and naming Oguri as the visionary behind the project. That sort of public discussion of Oguri presaged a fundamental shift in how his legacy was talked about, one that was indicative of a broader change in how the Meiji Restoration and the Tokugawa period were remembered during the 20th century. By this time, obviously, the sides of the conflict during Oguri's lifetime were a bit less charged, for lack of a better word. Support of the shogunate was not quite as much of a black mark against someone now that the shogunate had been dead for half a century and was obviously not coming back. With some historical distance, the conflicts of the 1860s started to look less like good supporters of the emperor versus bad opponents and more of a heroes on every side type of story. Oguri was well situated for this kind of treatment, given how closely his politics hewed to the policies of the Meiji state. His concern with national power and national prestige fit well with the goals of the government which had him executed. Still, he was never as popular as other figures more directly associated with the winning side, your Ito Hirobumis, your Yamagata Aritomos, and so on, but he did have at least one thing going for him. He was a military hero, a father of the modern navy, and surely there was no way that could ever make him look really, really bad. Enter the year 1945. Because, interestingly, the end of the Second World War is a sort of pivot point for assessments of the losers of the Meiji Restoration. Which makes a certain kind of sense, actually. Defeat in the Second World War represented, in a certain sense, the defeat of the entire dream of the Meiji Restoration, of making Japan a Western-style imperial power which, like Britain or France, could assure its power and security through military and economic might. Now, instead, Japan was a shattered country occupied by a foreign power. And that change in circumstance led to a re-evaluation of historical heroes and a reconsideration of what made them heroic. Previously, heroism had been defined, in large part, as loyalty to the emperor and the imperial throne. Even government critics and defenders of Oguri during the late Meiji era had gone to great pains to show how Oguri was not disloyal to the emperor by supporting the shogunate. They had also pushed, of course, to make him a founding figure of the navy. Suddenly, those two things were a lot less popular than they once had been. And as a result of this shift in the public discourse after 1945, there's been an interesting change in how Oguri is remembered in Japan today. Some, like the historical novelist Shiba Ryotaro, of whom we will speak much more next week, or, well, pretty much any historian writing on the era, described him as a reactionary whose adherence to outmoded feudal values and obsession with military strength had been a negative influence on Japan, a presaging of the militarism of the 20th century. Others, particularly historians from Gunma Prefecture, where most of his fiefdoms had been and where he was killed, held him up as a local icon, someone who, unlike most Japanese government figures since, actually cared about a mountainous, not particularly wealthy interior area like Gunma. To this very day, Tozenji, a Buddhist temple in Gunma, holds a yearly commemoration of Oguri's execution, during which he is still valorized as a hero. A local manga artist, Kimura Naomi, even created a manga based on his life. Oguri's legacy remains a complicated one, bound up not just in his own life, but in all that has happened since. He is a local hero and an icon of Japanese patriotism, who stood up for what he believed in, and who conveniently is less tainted with some of the reactionary anti-foreignism of the whole expel the barbarians crowd. But in the eyes of others, he's a reactionary, a feudalist, who was more interested in power for his liege lord than anything else. He's a militarist or a patriot, looking to defend his country or make it into an imperial power. Oguri's legacy is not settled, because the legacy of Japan's past is not settled. Even today, there's an interesting historical debate in Japan around assessing the legacies of the Edo period, once portrayed in pro- and anti-government histories as backwards and a time best cast into the dustbin of history. It's really only what came next where there's any disagreement. Now the Edo period is increasingly looked at as a time of prosperity that gave birth to much of what we think of as modern Japanese culture, and men like Oguri, who were very much of that time, are getting second looks as a result. And this ultimately is the thing about history. In a certain sense, it's not really about the past. History is about making sense of the past in light of the present, about organizing the past into a story that helps us explain who we are and how we got here, using rules around evidence and logic. And that process will never end because the present never ends. And so reinterpretations of the Edo period, the Meiji Restoration, and Oguri Tadamasa are here with us to stay. That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. This show is part of the Facing Backward Podcast Network. You can find out more about this show and our other shows at facingbackward.com or our social media, facebook.com/facingbackwardpodcasts, or for the time it is still alive, at Backward History on Twitter. You can support the network at patreon.com/facingbackward. Special thanks to those who have given it our shout-out tier: Jan Leonard, Stephen Elkins, Martin Oliveira, Clark Canning, Ian Kellett, Matt Haynes, Jackie Frostocker, Monkey Sack, Alayla McCulloch, Karen Murphy, Peter Wales, Robert Prine, William, Arno, Jonas Brandis, Nicholas Kroll, Jerry Spinrad, Jared Stevens, Jeffrey Dwork, Stefan Hruschka, Joshua Kane, Robian Cat, Jacob Key, A House Is, In Fact, a Perfectly Cromulent Mascot, and The Fish I Catch Are Rhodes Scholars, compared to Samuel Alito, Schmuck. You can also find out more about this show in particular at facebook.com/historyofjapanpodcast. Thanks again for listening, and I will see you next week when, after 400-something episodes, we will finally do a long-awaited episode on the Shinsengumi.